Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
Today is the last of my series of intimate partner and domestic partner homicides in 2018. And today's actually two stories. I did in no way capture all of the homicides that happened in 2018, only the ones that I could find a glimmer of information on. And I'm combining the two stories today because, well, one, there wasn't that much information available again on either one of them. And they both happened in October of 2018. And who am I to choose whose story gets told and whose doesn't? And now, sadly, both of these are from British Columbia today. This is the murders of Anita Magnetta and Aspen Pallett.
I don't remember anything after I left the house until I got to jail.
The law didn't come into my mind. I wasn't caring about the law. I was dealing with dead children on my hands. Fuck the law. I'm in trouble, man. My kids are dead.
But once I lied, I continued to lie. Yes, sir.
Wow.
You know, oh, what a tangled web we weave. But once I told a lie, I had to keep lying.
And what kind of person would do something like that? I know. I'm asking you, what kind of person do you think would do something like that?
Obviously, not someone, not a good person.
We're going to start with the story of Anita Magnetta. And although I have all of the factual information that's direct from the court documents on both Anita and Aspen's stories, I don't have any background information on either one of the victims. I could not find a single photo on either one of them. There's no family members' names, no obituaries, and the average word count for any of the articles that I could find on the cases was 137. 137 words, and none of them that describe the victims other than their ages and their race. I mean, I can't say I'm surprised. I did, however, find one quote from an officer, Sergeant Frank Jang of IHIT, who said, "Anita Magnetta's murder is a tragic example of the extreme consequences of domestic violence. Investigating homicides is not only mentally but emotionally taxing, and this case certainly was no exception." So I only know that Anita was in her 40s in 2018 and was originally from South Sudan, but had been living in Washington in the summer of 2008. I know that she has at least one brother, but I don't have a name for him. And he is currently living in Sudan. And it sounds like Anita did not have any family here in Canada or in the U.S. And that summer of 2008 that she was in Washington, she met a man named Rizik Bonan. Now, Rizik was also from Sudan, but had moved to Canada in May of 1998 to Alberta, where he went to university here and then got his MBA before marrying Anita on January 28th, 2012, which they did back in Sudan, and then they returned to Canada together in June of 2013. Now, fortunately for both of them, they didn't have any children together. Now, I can only surmise that the relationship was rather turbulent over the next 10 years. Rizik describes it as not without conflict. And by August of 2018, Anita had left the relationship and was living in what the court calls a transitional house. Now, I made sure to look up the actual definition of transitional housing in Alberta because I wanted to make sure that it couldn't include the possibility of it being like a halfway house or a residential treatment center for addictions, and it does not. The definition is, a transition house is a safe, temporary, 24/7 staffed shelter that provides housing and support for women and their children who are at risk of violence or who have experienced violence. Most transition houses are residential homes in confidential locations where women and families live together. Support workers in these homes provide emotional support, crisis intervention, safety planning, and access to services and supports for decision-making, short-term shelter or housing, and referrals. Now, this definition is important for some circumstantial stuff that comes later. So Anita was living in what most of us would refer to as a house that had been provided to her by a woman's shelter. And she was there for about 3 weeks when she was actually diagnosed with what the court referred to as a small brain tumor, which by the sounds of it would have required possibly some surgery, maybe some chemo, but was ultimately given a good survival rate. So she wasn't dying per se or expected to die from this brain tumor, but she did go back and live with Rizik in their basement apartment in Surrey. And this was a house, and the landlord or the owner lived above the couple, and then they lived downstairs in their own separate suite. Now, it's probably noteworthy here to mention that there was obviously some violence between the couple up to this point. Which hence the shelter that she was living in, but neither of them had any criminal convictions on their records for it. So it was all either unreported and undocumented, or there was just no criminal charges that had ever been laid against either one of them. And again, I think this is important to that we're going to kind of circle back to later. But there was mentioned in the court documents that a lot of the issues between the two of them had to do with allegations of infidelity. Now, where that they got that information from, I don't know, but it is documented in the sentencing documents. In the early morning hours of October 5th, 2018, police received a call. Now, who exactly called and what was said, I don't know, but after receiving the call, the police responded to the basement suite with enough concern for Anita's safety that when finding the door locked, they broke it down with a battering ram to gain entry to the place. And around this time, apparently, Rizik had walked into a police station and turned himself in. So what they found in that apartment was traumatizing to even the most seasoned officer. Anita was on the floor in the second bedroom, so it wasn't the master bedroom where they would have slept, but I don't think it was being actually used as a spare room. I think it was more like an office or storage space. Near Anita and the pooled and starting to congeal blood that was beneath her was a baseball bat and a machete, both with blood on them. Now, the paramedics that had been waiting for the police to clear the scene made their way in, but it was apparent that Anita was beyond any help. Rizik told the police that the whole thing was self-defense. They had had a number of heated arguments over the years and had been told by friends that they needed counseling, but that Anita had always refused it, as she was always the aggressor, and one time she had poked him with the tip of a knife. There was no serious injuries to that, but he claimed that he had been poked with this knife, and it was just the tip, as they say. And then another time that she had struck him over the head with a flower pot. So on the late evening of the 4th, there was yet another argument, and she had come at him with this machete. Now, why they would have a machete in their apartment, they said they used it for camping, but it's a strange thing to have just laying around your apartment. So to defend himself, he threw a lamp at her, picked up the baseball bat, which they also had laying around. He swung it at her twice, I guess, because he didn't have great aim. He wanted to knock the machete out of her hand, apparently, but missed. And when he saw that she had crumpled down to the floor at his second swing, he realized she was having trouble speaking. He didn't realize until then that he had actually struck her in the head, not intentionally, of course, but by accident. So rather than call 911 and shout, "Holy Jesus," until the upstairs landlord came to help, he did what any of us would do in a moment of self-defense, that is. He gathered some of his clothes, walked out the front door, locking it behind him, and then walked down the block to his car, where he drove around calling his friends, asking them what he should do. And when he finally got a hold of one of his friends in Edmonton, who told him, "Like, call 911 and turn himself in," he did that, but it was about an hour or so after walking out the front door. And he was allowed at his trial to use this self-defense argument, but here's the thing. Well, there's a couple of things. So first of all is the fact that Anita had been the one living in this transition house, not him. And although there had been no prior assault charges on Rizig, there wasn't on Anita either. Like, likely because his reporting of their relationship wasn't all that accurate. There was also the matter of the autopsy findings. Now, I'm going to warn you, this is going to be a bit disturbing, to say the least, to hear. But when paramedics and the police got to the house and saw Anita, now remember, I said that it was clear to them that she was beyond any help. Well, that's because she had been beaten about the head so badly that she was unrecognizable. And Dr. Doyle was the medical examiner that did the autopsy, and he found that she had multiple injuries, including a star-like laceration over her left eyebrow, a laceration close to her eyes, a laceration of her left lower eyelid, a collapsed eye globe of her left eye, a laceration of her lip, a star laceration of her upper lip, several teeth either broken or completely knocked out, a fracture of the upper portion of her jaw, a star laceration of her scalp with a skull fracture underneath, a fracture of her nose bone, and fractures to the base of her skull. The injuries were consistent with blunt force trauma from a baseball bat with tremendous force and a minimum of 3 blows to the head at least. Her death would have been within a few minutes of the first or second blow. And then while executing the search warrant on their apartment, Constable Pacholak, who was, he had come the next afternoon, so on the afternoon of the 6th, there was on the table that was in the living room, it was a gray colored binder with some papers, and within this stack of papers was a handwritten note that had been ripped out of one of those coil type notebooks. His handwriting doesn't sound like it was all that legible, but what Constable Pacholak could make out was, removing the car from the driveway made me to suspect that my wife, who knew how upset I was when I saw that car in the driveway, told him to remove it, that in addition to the sex tapes that I recorded, confirmed to me the affair through, though my wife remained adamant it did not happen, which is contrary to what I have in the tapes. At trial, Rizig tried to get his defense attorneys to have the note thrown out, claiming that it was hearsay, which I don't think is the actual definition of hearsay. I know that hearsay is a very complex legal issue, but whatever. Or actually, I think it was because they didn't put up like a handwriting expert or anything like that, which is, to me, is kind of like a body language analysis. It's interesting, but I don't think it's not really a science like DNA, which is irrefutable. Anyways, it was admissible. And although he was allowed this self-defense argument and took the stand on his own behalf, but as the justice said in his sentencing decision, Mr. Bona requested that the jury should be instructed on the defense of self-defense and the defense of provocation. Provocation is a legal term for basically poking the bear. I acceded to both of those requests. By their verdict, the jury found that this was not the case of was not a case of self-defense and that it was not a case of provocation. They found that Mr. Bona had the intent necessary for murder, that he intended to kill his wife or intended to cause her bodily harm, that he knew was likely to cause her death and was reckless whether death ensued or not. So he was given a life sentence with eligibility for parole after 11 years. Now, sadly, there was no victim impact statements read into court, but the prosecutor was able to get a hold of one of Anita's brothers in Sudan, who basically told them that they are heartbroken and distraught over Anita's death. It is so sad that she essentially died alone with no support around her. And how terrible for the family back in Sudan to think that, you know, she's here in Canada, she's having this great life, and then she gets murdered by the person that's supposed to be there and be her safe place for her.
88% of the work week is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
But I just want to discuss a couple of things about this appeal, which you might not find all that interesting, but I always do. On March 22nd, 2021, he filed his appeal regarding both his conviction and the sentence. And lots of the usual blah, blah, blah arguments about instructions to the jury and whatnot. But also he argued ineffective assistance of counsel, that they didn't do what he wanted him to do. But here's the thing that I find really interesting about this. It's just stuff that I didn't know before. So he claimed at the time of the trial that he didn't have any money. He had no income. He was in debt about $15,000 despite owning a car and some RSPs. So he originally had a court-appointed attorney for his trial. Now, here's what I didn't know about that. So apparently, you know how when they read you your rights, they always say you have the right to an attorney if you can't afford an attorney. Well, I've always figured that if I was ever charged with, say, murder, which FYI, I would have to have been framed to have that ever happen to me. Well, of course I couldn't afford a lawyer. Like, I'm picturing hundreds of thousands of dollars for like a 4 to 7 week trial, which most of them are for murder. Well, it turns out most of us can and would have to. Like, the financial qualifications for legal aid is like $25,000 a year annual income. And legal aid, get this, it isn't actually free. According to their website, now this is in Alberta, the majority of legal aid services are not free. For most issues, legal aid lawyers charge a reduced hourly rate of $125 plus miscellaneous fees. The fees a lawyer can charge are outlined in the legal aid tariff. A copy of the tariff is available on our website. Legal aid pays your lawyer during your case, and we work with you to set up a repayment plan. Clients are expected to repay Legal Aid Alberta for their lawyer's services. There is no interest on a bill with Legal Aid Alberta, and you are not responsible to pay GST. So I guess getting repaid is their only sort of motivation to sort of get you off of the charges. But I guess that's the case with any defense lawyer. Anyways, you can also be denied legal aid, not just because you make too much money, but also if they don't believe that there's merits to your case being successful, which is mostly applies to appeals on sentencing and those kinds of things. Now, if that happens to you, that you're denied legal aid, you still have a hope of getting a lawyer appointed for you. But first, you have to appeal that decision by legal aid. You have to then be denied your appeal to legal aid, and then you have to take the proof that you've been denied this appeal to legal aid, come before a judge under what's called a Robothan application, and prove that you can't afford a lawyer and that the case is just too complicated based on your educational or life experience to handle on your own. And then the judge has to determine if there's any likelihood of success for you. And in the end, they would probably still tell you you can in fact afford a lawyer. Now, duty counsel, which is still technically legal aid, that is free, and they can help anyone, even if you're like a gabillionaire. They are sort of the first lawyers that you would have any kind of contact with. They're sort of like on standby, which will give you kind of like your initial advice, which is probably just say nothing and don't take a polygraph. They can file your initial guilty or not guilty plea, but it's really pretty limited what they actually do for you. And after that, you're best to get a lawyer. So it sounds like if you're arrested for a major crime, like forget worrying about life in prison. Your first concern will be like not having to sell your house and like cash in all your retirement savings to pay for a lawyer. So let's hope that none of us ever get framed for murder. Now, I could be wrong on some of that because it seems like everyone and their dog gets a free lawyer here in Alberta. So maybe it's easier to get one for free, but I'm not about to do anything where I have to find out. Like I'm not going to do any kind of real world research here for you guys. And some of you are thinking like, Kim, you're an idiot. Like, how did you not know that? Well, I don't really have an answer for that. I guess it just never came up that I needed a lawyer. I mean, I've never even fought a parking ticket before. Anyways, he was denied legal aid on this appeal for non-financial reasons, being that they didn't feel he had anything to appeal that had any merit. So he begged the judge for a lawyer, and the judge had to weigh if filing his appeal and having a lawyer was in the interest of justice. And a lot of blah, blah, blah happened. And in the end, he was appointed a lawyer for his appeal. But the judge was pretty sure that it would turn out that the lawyer would find there's no validity to the appeal and it would likely just be abandoned. So it sounds like it's a lot easier to get a lawyer appointed for you for trials, but appeals, not so much. Anyways, you probably hated all of that, but I am very interested in legal stuff when it comes to murder trials. So if there's any lawyers out there listening, email me because I have questions. You're also going to hate the fact that I have no idea the outcome of that appeal, but chances are he's still in prison, eligible for parole in 2029. And that was the brutal murder of Anita Meganaya. So now we're going to move on to the lovely 19-year-old Aspen Pallett, who was a daughter, a granddaughter, maybe a sister, but definitely a someone. And her story is worthy of being told, even though her story has not been told properly up to this point. And I can't properly tell it here because there's just so little is known publicly about her. But Aspen was 19. She had a boyfriend named Solaris Day, whose full name is actually Solaris Anata Running Day. He was 22, and they'd been together for about a year. I'm not sure how they met, but if you see a picture of him, he looks just like a quiet, pretty normal kid, clean cut, wears glasses, the type of kid that you would see at any mall or in a coffee shop, just a really regular kid. But Solaris did have some issues, not of any violent kind, but he was a little bit troubled. Based on the court documents, it sounds like he had some anxiety and didn't have a lot of family support in his life. His dad was mostly absent and his mom was living in a very remote community near Port Hardy. It sounds like he was raised partially by his maternal grandmother. She was a Blackfoot woman, but she had started to suffer from dementia around 2015. And it was around that time that Solaris started to have some mental health issues. But those issues were caused mostly by his regular use of weed and a little bit of meth. Now, cannabis-induced psychosis, it's a thing, and it's actually happening more and more here in Canada because marijuana is now legal in Canada, and it's really strong stuff, and it can cause psychosis with heavy regular use. Solaris had taken up weed at 16. He managed to finish high school, and by 20, he'd had his first psychotic episode from it. And he was hospitalized in 2015. And when that happens to you, like normally, as long as you quit the weed, you get better and you stay better. But if you keep doing weed, you are now predisposed to psychosis. The like the drug-induced kind of psychosis, which is treated differently under the law than the regular brain chemistry type. And if you keep doing it, it can actually lead to regular, like the regular never going to go away kind. And it sounds like after this first episode, he kept doing it. So in 2017, he was living in Hornby Island. And on November 21st, 2017, he actually went missing. Like as in there were news releases that he was missing and RCMP and friends were worried about his safety because it wasn't like him to go off grid like that. But he was located safe on December 5th, 2017. Now, I don't know if Aspen was his girlfriend at that time, but Aspen and her mom, whom I don't know her name, unfortunately, took him in as a little bit of a stray. Like they really wanted to help him, felt that he was a really good kid. He'd just kind of been kicked around by life a lot. And it seemed like he maybe lacked some life skills and just that adulting was really hard for him. So Aspen's mom would book his appointments for him and just kind of stepped in that mom figure role that he just really needed. So things were good until July of 2018 when it happened again. And at that time, he was living in Richmond, BC, and was definitely with Aspen at that time of his life. So he was sent to St. Paul's Hospital for a short-term stay, but he wasn't really better. So he went back in September, but this time he went to the Richmond General Hospital. And while he was there, he was under the care of Dr. Shabbats, who relayed that there are three major clusters of symptoms of psychosis, which are delusions, hallucinations, and thought form disorder. Psychosis can be caused by major mental illness, a chemical imbalance in the brain, or by illicit drug use. Now, when he assessed him, he suspected at the time that it was the drug-induced variety. He got better very quickly, which is consistent with that type of psychosis. So he was released again and prescribed some antipsychotics because he was pretty sure that he was not going to stay off the weed and was worried that because it had happened to him a couple of times before, maybe it was here to stay, but he couldn't quite be sure. But during his final week that he'd been in the hospital, he was fine. Everything was really good with him. So he told him adamantly, like, you'll probably be okay, but you need to stay off of the drugs. So he was released on October 1st, 2018, and he went to stay at Aspen's mom place with her. And he was kind of in that place of like, I'm never doing that again. I want to break free of all this crap and just put it behind me and make something out of my life. And Aspen and her mom are like, you got this. And as chance would have it, the day that he got out of the hospital, Aspen and him ran into an acquaintance of hers, Trevor Berry. And Trevor wasn't ignorant of the kinds of issues that Solaris was having in his life. Trevor had had some anxiety himself and was currently living alone at 7460 Westminster Highway and really wanted to rent out the other bedroom that he had to help with some of the bills. I believe he knew that Solaris wasn't working at the time because he would have just gotten out of the hospital, but he might have been living off some kind of social assistance, which meant that he would have had some money coming in. So Trevor said, why don't you come and stay with me? So this was a great solution, they thought. So the next day, on the 2nd of October, he moved into Trevor's place, which probably didn't really involve a lot of moving of stuff. It was just kind of his personal stuff. So the next day, so this is now October 3rd, 2018, it was a Wednesday. Trevor goes off to work in the morning, leaving Solaris there to unpack, just do his thing. Now he, meaning Trevor, came back home around 3. They talked a little bit together. Solaris was writing some stuff, like I guess he just liked to write, like a journal or something. Showed Trevor some of what he was working on, and then Trevor took off to go to the gym. Came home again around 5:30 p.m. Solaris had ordered pizza during that time for himself, offered some of it to Trevor, and then they played a board game of some sort together. And because Trevor had some anxiety issues himself, he was working on some of his own stuff. He lived very much by routine. So he went outside to smoke a little bit of weed himself. This was around 7 o'clock, which he did every night to sort of help him sleep. And when he came back in, it was about 7:30. He went to his room for the night, where he would like watch a little bit of Netflix on his computer, or maybe just play a game or something. And around 8:30, there was a knock on the door and it was Aspen coming to see Solaris. So Trevor went to Solaris's room to, you know, let him know that she was there and he wasn't there. So Trevor told Aspen, well, you can sit and wait for him in his room if you want. So she did that. And about 30 minutes later, from his room, Trevor could hear the two of them talking, which sounded like it was in the hallway between the bedrooms. Now, he was wearing headphones, though, so he couldn't make out what they were saying, but it was just kind of regular conversation. And then Trevor went to bed around 10 o'clock like he always did. Well, close to 1 a.m., Trevor's awoken by some rather insistent pounding on the front door. He didn't even have time to get up and, like, get to the front door when the police, with guns drawn, burst into the house and took him, like he's standing there in the hallway, blinking around, confused in his underwear, into custody for what they referred to as some drug offenses. And he's like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, I was asleep. And the EMS workers are like rushing in behind the officers, and Trevor is just suddenly living this absolute nightmare and probably hoping he cannot afford an attorney. And he's asking repeatedly, like, what's going on? What's going on? And the paramedics that had come in have found Aspen in Solaris's bedroom dead from what was an apparent overdose. And if you're thinking, like, Kim, like, fill me in here because that makes no sense. I'm going to try. So at 11:39, Solaris had come into the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel, which is directly across the street from Trevor's house, and used their phone to call 911. He told dispatch that he was worried about his girlfriend because she was doing some drugs with his roommate, and they, but he wasn't really specific about who the they was, whether it was Aspen and Trevor, Trevor and Solaris, or Solaris and Aspen, had gotten into an argument and Trevor had told him to leave, like go for a walk or something. And Solaris did that thinking Trevor, he just knew that Solaris shouldn't be around people doing drugs. But after he left the house, he heard Aspen give like a yelp. He described it as a yelp, but he later described it as more like a scream and he was really worried about her. And that phone call to 911 set into motion a bunch of things that all happened sort of at the same time. Police arrived at the house to find Trevor in his underwear and Aspen dead from what looks very much like an overdose. At the same time, Solaris is flagging down a constable in the parking lot of the Sheraton across the street and reiterates his story that Trevor and Aspen were doing drugs. He was asked to leave, and then he heard Aspen scream. And the officer asked him if he had consumed any drugs that night, and he said no. And the officer used a flashlight to look in his pupils, and everything looked normal. So he was put into a police cruiser as soon as Aspen was found deceased. And they had suspected at that time that Trevor had maybe hotshotted Aspen or something. And he was asked a few more questions along those kind of lines. Solaris said that he had left the house about 25 minutes ago and that Aspen was alive and well when he'd left. He didn't really know what kind of drugs they were doing, but it looked just kind of like a regular joint. He did tell the officer that he had just been released from the hospital and that he was easily confused. But the only really inconsistency from his 911 statement was that after he'd heard the scream, that he thought that they'd gotten to an argument, which was slightly different than his initial statement that the argument had started before he left. So while Trevor's being taken down to the station to give his statement about how Aspen suddenly wound up dead with him alone in the house with her, Solaris was also taken into the Richmond RCMP detachment at 2 a.m. to give his formal statement. And it was into a room that they refer to as a soft interview room because he's a witness at this point. He's not a suspect. But during his interview, Constable Stowe, who was questioning him, left the room to go talk to the coroner. Now, the coroner at that point, he hadn't already done any kind of official autopsy, but he did take note of anything that was kind of apparent at first glance, and he had noted some bruising on Aspen's body. So Constable Stowe went back into the room, and he asked if he could take some photos of Solaris's hands. And Solaris was fine with that. Well, Constable Stowe did notice that Solaris's hands were a little bit red, puffy, and had a couple of small cuts on them. But other than that, it looked like Aspen had died of an overdose, and Constable Stowe just wanted to make sure that Solaris wasn't doing drugs with them together and all of that. He said that he had actually been clean for 6 months and planned on staying that way. The only detail that he really added to that evening is that Aspen and him had eaten dinner together, some pepperoni, grapefruit, and some water, which sounds like an odd meal, but when you're young and poor, you eat whatever you have around. And when the urinalysis that was done on Solaris at the station was negative for any drugs or alcohol, so he was released and took a cab from the station back to the house, I assume. It wasn't really being treated as a crime scene or like a homicide, so he would have been able to go home. Meanwhile, Trevor gave his statement, denied using any drugs with Aspen, and asked Solaris to leave the house. None of that had happened, he said. He reiterated his own story that he was asleep. He was woken up by some noise, came out of his room, and was arrested and taken into a police cruiser. And he saw, like, when he was being taken into the police cruiser, he saw Solaris sort of pacing around the parking lot across the street, and he didn't know nothing about nothing. Well, a couple of hours later, so maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, Solaris took a cab back to the station where Constable McGuire was just getting off duty and leaving the building when Solaris approached him and said to him, "I'd like to admit some crimes." To which McGuire said, "Well, what crimes?" And he said, "I murdered my girlfriend." So McGuire put him into handcuffs, took him inside where he actually fainted, but he made no other statement any kind about how he had murdered her, why he had murdered her, when. Like, he, as soon as he was arrested, he completely stopped talking. He never made another statement. So in order to make any kind of case for murder, they only have that one statement that he made, which isn't really, to me, an actual confession. I mean, lots of times when someone dies, a person's going to say, "It's all my fault," or "I killed them," which is a statement out of like misplaced guilt. Like if I'd left 2 minutes earlier or later, or if I hadn't have done this or whatever, that it wouldn't have happened. It's not necessarily a confession that you actually killed the person or that you're guilty of murder. So the only thing that they have to tell Aspen's story now is the results of the autopsy, which were done the next day by Dr. Carol Lee. And the autopsy was actually very confusing. Toxicology showed a bit of cannabis in her system, but not near the level that would have been deadly. And no other drugs or alcohol in her system, just the weed. There was no signs of any kind of like allergic reaction to anything, no swelling of the airways or microscopic signs of like any kind of pre-existing condition or anything like that. But she did have 2 intramuscular hemorrhages near the carotid artery, which delivers oxygen to the brain. And these hemorrhages would have happened within 24 hours before she died. But there was no external injuries like from strangulation. So this was basically an internal bruise, which caused like was caused by like breaking blood vessels, which normally happens when asphyxia is suspected. There was also no petechial hemorrhages in the eyes, which normally are associated with asphyxia. So Dr. Lee put Aspen's time of death at her best estimate of a few hours before she was discovered. So by like 1 a.m. when EMS found her, she had probably been dead for as long as 12 hours and as little as 6. So 1 p.m. the next day, which we know is not true, or like maybe 7 to 8 p.m., which we also know isn't true. Based on Solaris's statement, this would have happened probably like 9:30. But Dr. Lee did say that these estimates that they make are not very accurate because there's just too many variables involved. So time of death is usually just kind of a guess. So in this case, her guess was made based on the level of rigor when she was examined. Asphyxia is also not an exact science. There's no external injuries. To have no external injuries is actually not uncommon. It can be caused by suffocation, smothering. So it's not just choking, strangulation, or hanging that does it. So in the end, she had to put undetermined under the cause of death, but was able to testify that based on all the information that had been provided to her, including Solaris's statement, that she had likely had died of asphyxia by strangulation, but wasn't able to rule out completely some things like maybe sleep apnea, seizure, cardiac arrhythmia. They were possible, but not probable. Now, in Dr. Lee's report, she put a few things that I always like to use as sort of reminders about choking when it comes to domestic homicides. First, I always like to remind you that if you're ever choked in a relationship, even just one time, you are 750 times more likely to be murdered by that person than, of course, by any other person on the planet. Your odds of dying go up big time in that moment. So if you do survive it, you need to get out and stay out safely, of course, with a plan. Please reach out for help and support. But the other reminders are that as little as 6 pounds of pressure can cut off your oxygen supply to the brain, and that you can lose consciousness in about 10 to 15 seconds if, of course, the person lets go, as in makes the choice to stop choking you, you'll regain consciousness very quickly and you'll live. If they make the choice to continue, your body will start to convulse, making the person apply more pressure and really commit to their choice. And then death occurs within 7 minutes, with severe brain damage setting in after about a minute and a half. Now, 2 to 6 minutes is the average time for you to die from strangulation or smothering. So what you should do is put on a timer for let's say the low end, 2 minutes, and then just stand over your bed with like your hand on a pillow and then just press down. I mean, make sure no animals or no person is under the pillow first, please. And then just while you're waiting for the timer to count down, just consider what that means. Like, take in what you're thinking, what you're feeling, the sensation in your bodies as you do it, and consider the sensations in another person's body if they were under that pillow. And then imagine the person that you love doing that to you for that length of time. Anyways, the Crown prosecutor charged Solaris Day with second-degree murder, but the defense said there was no actual evidence of any murder that Solaris had in any way, shape, or form caused Aspen's death, and that the matter went to trial by judge only, so there was no jury. And they actually did raise some good points. There is a difference under the law of culpable and non-culpable homicide. A person commits homicide when directly or indirectly by any means he or she causes the death of a human being. So culpable means they have to have known, or had, like, any reasonable person would have known that their actions were likely to result in death. And so homicide itself can include murder or manslaughter. Now, if it's culpable homicide, that's considered murder. So that's where the person who causes the death of a human being means to cause his death, or means to cause him bodily harm that he knows is likely to cause death, and is reckless whether death ensues or not. Thus, murder is a specific intent offense, and in order for it to be murder, the Crown has to prove beyond any reasonable doubt the foresight of likelihood of death on the part of the accused, meaning the person had to know that death was likely and based on their specific actions. Now, manslaughter is what they call a residual catch-all offense for various forms of culpable homicide. The most frequent ways in which homicide is committed, or at least charged, is by criminal neglect and an unlawful act. Now, an unlawful act is any action that is inherently dangerous and carries with it an objective risk of bodily harm to the victim. So in order to get a murder conviction for Solaris, they would have had to prove that Solaris not only caused Aspen's death, but that he did it through an unlawful act, which is assault, and that that specific act of assault was dangerous enough for him to have known that it would have killed her, which is choking. But what's interesting is, by going with the defense that there was no murder, that and that Solaris wasn't there when she died, they couldn't also at the same time say that Solaris was not criminally responsible or NCR due to a mental disorder, which would be the psychosis. So in the end, Justice Michael Tamman had to decide if Solaris caused Aspen's death and if it was the result of an unlawful act on his part. So he looked at kind of everything, and then had to determine what was probable under the circumstances. Dr. Lee said it was probable that Aspen had died of asphyxia, which is an unlawful act. And then Trevor said that he heard voices between 8 to 10 p.m., and it was probable that it was Aspen and Solaris talking. Solaris had deliberately lied about Trevor and Aspen doing drugs, so there was no evidence of that, and that he gave the same story to the 911 operator and the two officers that he spoke to. He was not under the influence of any drugs at the time of his interviews. So the judge said in his decision, specifically, those lies tend to show that the accused knew that Miss Palette was dead when he called 911 and that he was with her when she died. The lies were obviously intended to point to either an alternative cause of death, drug overdose, or a different perpetrator, Mr. Berry. Those lies, deliberately told in circumstances where police were not yet investigating any crime, form part of the incriminating web in which the accused is entangled. the act of assaulting an individual by manual strangulation, rendering them unconscious, and then continuing to apply pressure to the neck is inherently dangerous. It carries with it a risk of bodily harm to the victim that is more than trivial and transitory. Any person engaging in such conduct would be aware of that risk. Thus, the mental element required for manslaughter is present here. So he was able to prove that it was manslaughter, but not murder, I'll read it here from the documents. The difficulty I have in finding to the criminal standard that the accused subjectively knew death was likely if he continued to strangle Miss Pallett is the absence of evidence as to the duration of that strangulation, or indeed any evidence of the surrounding circumstances. Dr. Lee did not give a minimum duration of sustained pressure needed to cause death. From her evidence, all I can conclude is that pressure must have been applied for some time after Miss Pallett lost consciousness and likely exhibited some involuntary convulsive movements. The amount of time is indeterminate. There were no external injuries, no other injuries that might assist in assessing amount and duration of pressure applied. For instance, in some cases of manual strangulation, the hyoid bone is broken, indicating sustained pressure for a prolonged period of time, and that is not so here. However, recognition of inherent dangerousness of the act, one that is easily capable of causing death, merely takes one as far as manslaughter. It does not cross the threshold into the specific intent required for murder. I reiterate, nothing short of a specific intent on the part of the perpetrator can cause bodily harm that he has subjectively known, that he subjectively knows is likely to cause death, will suffice for a conviction of murder. So he was found guilty of manslaughter, which doesn't come with any mandatory minimum sentences like it does with murder. And Aspen's mom said, after everything my family gave, he took the one thing we couldn't bear to part with, my daughter. She paid the ultimate price for the kindness and compassion that we all showed. So in issuing the sentence, a bunch of things had to be kind of taken into consideration. And one of those things was that although there was no evidence at the time of taking Aspen's life that he was actually under psychosis, he did have some mental health issues. He was very young. He was only 22. He did not have any prior criminal record. But causing the death of an intimate partner is considered an aggravating factor because your partner is supposed to be a person of trustworthiness, and manual strangulation is also an aggravating factor because there's no way that it's an accident. The justice in the case of manslaughter has the option of applying any sentence that he wants to, basically from probation to up to a life sentence. The Crown asked for 7 to 8 years and the defense said 5 to 6 years. Generally, the justice goes kind of right down the middle to avoid appeals on sentencing. And both of them agreed that he would get credit for time spent already in jail, which at that time was 994 days or just under 3 years. However, they gave credit for that time served. They don't say, okay, you've been in jail for 2 years, so I'm taking 2 years off your full sentence. No. They give you 1.5 days for every day spent in jail because there is some dumb law that states that life in jail is really hard and some legal BS that I will never actually wrap my head around. So 994 actual days is 1,416 or closer to 4 years credit. So they round up, of course, to 4 years total. So no matter what sentence that he gave him, like if he gave him 8 years, he would only serve four more because four of them had already been served, apparently, even though in reality, it was only like 2.5 years of actual time on this planet, which we all have to do one day at a time. So in the end, he was given 2 years of prison time to serve in a federal penitentiary and then 3 years of probation after that, which includes a condition that he can have no contact with any member of Aspen's family. Anyway, so that was on June 25th, 2021. They always like to take the day that you're arrested as like your prison anniversary date. So he would have been released on October 4th of 2023. He missed his first probationary check-in on October 31st, which was supposed to be between October 31st and November 2nd. He was arrested again for breach of probation orders. And didn't bother updating his probation officer with his address. So he was picked up in early December of 2023, had a bail hearing on the 20th December. And I actually don't know anything after that. But from what I've seen, like even when you're on parole for a life sentence, they are reluctant to send you back to prison. So he probably just got a finger wagging and is living in Richmond, just kind of doing his thing. And that was the murder, manslaughter, whatever you choose to call it, the unlawful killing of Aspen Pallett, and the final in my official series of intimate partner homicides in Canada during the year 2018. So this season is actually winding down. I always end on the last Monday in October, and I'm actually taking a break after the season ender because I think it's next week. But your feed won't be empty because I have some plans for making sure that every Monday I'm still back. There's something in your feed to listen to. And I promise it's not going to be just a bunch of repeats. And next season, I'm thinking there's going to be some changes. It's still going to be on Mondays, but I'm going to try and aim for longer episodes, not just focused solely on Canadian cases. I want to cover cases that really just interest me for some reason or another, regardless of where they happened. And I don't think I'm going to be giving myself any more projects like this one. I really just want to explore a lot of topics like missing and murdered Indigenous people, legal stuff, investigation stuff, incels, different motives, all kinds of like just everything related to true crime. So expect some changes, but I'm still going to be your host. I'm still going to be very invested in what I'm doing. I'm still very much enjoying it. So I expect to continue to put out content next season as well. So I will be back again next week. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
88% of the work week is spent communicating, typing, talking, and going back and forth on topics until everyone is on the same page. It's time for a change. It's time for Grammarly. Grammarly's AI ensures your team gets the point across the first time, eliminating misunderstandings and streamlining collaboration. It goes beyond basic grammar to help tailor writing to specific audiences. Whether that means adding an executive summary, fine-tuning tone, or cutting out jargon in just one click. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly's AI boosts buy-in and moves work forward. It integrates seamlessly with over 500,000 apps and websites, is implemented in days, and is IT approved. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who trust Grammarly to elevate their communication. Visit grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.